You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2012 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. I've been on a culinary odyssey of late, my eyes jumping from one menu to the next at Roy Choi's restaurants, from his kabocha pudding cup at Chego to the churon nomang, pound cake churros at A-Frame. And in browsing through Ludo Lefebvre's newest recipe book, Ludo Bites, wondering when we'll be able to taste his creations once again, I just learned that his new restaurant, Le Hotier, fashioned on the French truck stop, is slated to open in the next months. The wonderful thing about these two guests is that what you knew about them, or what you know them for, is constantly changing, and may or may not be the roles they are playing now. That's what's so fascinating about both of their trajectories. Just like the city that embraces their work and influences their taste, they are always moving, experimenting, and pushing the boundaries of their field. With Roy's moniker, Papi Chulo, and the quirky blog that is part of his operation, to Ludo's self-description as a culinary gypsy, whose Ludo Bites concept is, in his words, like a painter who creates a different exhibit in a different location. You begin to get that these two chefs aren't just creating cuisine, they're creating culture in their own renegade, off-the-cuff, inventive way. So thanks for jumping along for the ride. Chef Ludo Lefebvre trained in France for 13 years before moving to Los Angeles to work at L'Angerie, where, as head chef, it became one of the top-rated restaurants in California. Ludo's now retired guerrilla-style pop-up event restaurants called Ludo Bites have been included in Jonathan Gold's 99 Most Essential Restaurant list for Los Angeles. In addition to Ludo Bites, Ludo is also the author of Crave, A Feast for the Five Senses. Roy Choi is a classically trained chef from Los Angeles who cut his teeth in the kitchens of Le Bernardin, the Embassy Suites, and the Beverly Hilton before discovering his roots as an Angeleno and channeling his soul into a taco that tastes a lot like LA. After launching Kogi BBQ in 2008, he followed with restaurants A-Frame and Sunny Spot. Roy is currently working on his first book, Spaghetti Junction, Riding Shotgun with an LA Chef, which is part memoir, part cookbook, and we hope he comes back for the release. Moderating the conversation tonight is Leslie Suter, the dine editor for Los Angeles Magazine. In May of this year, Leslie was the recipient of a prestigious James Beard Award. It was the first ever awarded for food coverage in a general interest publication. She has lent her culinary know-how to national publications and has appeared on a number of television and radio programs, including Hell's Kitchen, Top Chef Masters, and is a regular guest on KCRW's Good Food. We have Leslie to thank for helping bringing the food spotlight to our ever-deserving city. So please help me give a warm welcome to Ludo, Roy, and Leslie.
Hello. Thank you, Maureen, for that lovely introduction to all three of us. Thank you, Roy and Ludo, for joining me. And I want to thank the Library Foundation and the Los Angeles Public Library System for having us here today. It's a treat to be in the library tonight. And actually, tonight is a special night. It's the first night of the extended hours of the Public Library System. They're open till 8 p.m. Hooray! So we can now be doing all of our bookish activities later than usual, which is exciting. But we are here today to talk about dining in Los Angeles. And I think the conversation that we're going to have tonight is going to be a lot different than if we'd had this conversation 5 years ago, maybe even 2 years ago. I can relate this to myself. I am the dining editor of Los Angeles Magazine. That's my job. And when I took the job in 2007, when it was explained to me, it was rather simply, your job is to go to lovely fancy restaurants and write what you think about them. And it seemed rather straightforward. And I found out very quickly, and I've learned over the last 5 years, that I have done very little of that, and a lot more driving around the city, searching out food trucks and scouring Twitter for where the next one-night pop-up extravaganza was going to be. It was a lot more sort of guerrilla restaurant eating than my job was explained to me, which made my job a lot more exciting, but actually a lot more difficult. So thank you to both of you for making that a lot harder. But I will say it's a very exciting time in Los Angeles eating. I think what's going on right now in dining is so different. The white tablecloth is, you can't even find it. You're much more likely to have one of your best meals standing on a street corner or in some sort of deli after hours at a pop-up than you're going to find sitting down at a restaurant. And it's a really interesting time. And I think it's no coincidence that at the same time that we've been doing such sort of outside-the-box eating, that this is the same time that the rest of the world is starting to really pay attention to Los Angeles food. I think as soon as we stopped paying attention to what everyone else said we should be doing and started doing our own things, once Roy said, screw it, I'm gonna put my food in a truck and take it to the people on the streets, and once Ludo said, I'm gonna be a gypsy and just go to restaurants where they'll have me for a couple weeks and then move on to the next spot, I think once we really accepted our sort of anti-conformist attitudes here in LA, that's, I think, what's been getting the city a lot of respect when it comes to food. But saying that and shunning sort of the conventional restaurant space, both of these guys, both of you, as Maureen announced, came out of the conventional restaurant world. Roy, you came out of Le Bernardin and at hotel restaurants across the country. Ludo at L'Orangerie and Bastide, obviously haute fine dining cuisine. So I guess that's where I want to start the conversation, is asking a bit about how it is that two guys who came out of the conventional restaurant world came to be the iconic figures of anti-establishment guerrilla cooking in the city, because it's an interesting trajectory. I think I'll start just with Roy, just because you're sitting closest to me this evening. Thank you. I don't fight, I promise. So I think I want to start with you and just ask a bit about how, you know, the Kogi phenomenon and in part then sort of the food truck phenomenon came to be. And if you think that your trajectory through the conventional restaurant space led you down that path in any way.
Well, I don't know if you all are familiar with my story, but in a nutshell, I got laid off.
It's a common story.
Yeah, that was a long end of story. But I got laid off, and that was 2008. And I had reached pretty high in my career at that point. Running huge kitchens and hotels and, you know, shouldering a really big salary and all of these things. And then it was over. And then I was, you know, I would have gone back into the regular restaurant world or the hotel world, but no one wanted to hire me. And so because no one wanted to hire me, I think what happened to me is I started to evolve and change as a person. And I started to send off maybe a different energy and a different understanding of what I was absorbing and what I was transforming into. And I was really at a point where I wanted to leave cooking completely. But going back to having been trained, everything that happened after that through Kogi, I don't think could have happened if I wasn't trained, because I broke a lot of rules. You know, I broke a lot of rules on the streets. Changed.
Not laws so much as rules.
Laws,
okay.
Too. Yeah, well, yeah, but that's
what I
yeah,
thought.
Yeah, that's for the LA County prison talk. Uh-huh, yeah. This is that library. but we broke a lot of like rules. But in order to know those rules, to break them, you got to know them. So they weren't rules that were broken out of disrespect. They were rules that were broken at a point where I completely lived through those and realized how I could play jazz with them versus just like banging an instrument.
Food jazz.
Food jazz, definitely.
Ludo, I'll ask you the same question. Bastide, L'Orangerie, those were sort of the pinnacle. And after that, a high-profile Las Vegas restaurant as well. And then immediately into, you know, an after-hours thing at a bakery serving really, you know, high radical experimental gastronomy. So how did your path take you to that?
I mean, look, I work all my life. I work in fancy restaurant, and in France after Laurangerie, Bastide. I did not get fired from Bastide, but almost. See, me too. You know, I left just before to get fired. And I feel
that's
it.
The key. Yeah.
That's the key, chef. But
I need to learn.
You get the unemployment that way.
And after I get a big opportunity to go to Las Vegas, and like Chef Roy, you know, yeah, you make a big money. You know, it's crazy. And so I went over there. I learned a lot about management and manage a kitchen with 50 cooks doing 800 covers a night. Wow. It was a good experience, but it was not for me. And I realized money is not just about money. So I quit my job over there just before I get fired again. Because I'm smart.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I don't wait for that, chef. And I came back to LA. I said to Chrissy, you know, my wife, I said, what am I going to do now? You know, just what am I going to do? I mean, I want to open my restaurant, of course. And I think I was ready, you know, after my experience in Las Vegas with managing and what is think, you know, computer, you know, money, food costs. And but I realized, you know what? At that time in 2009, it was very, very difficult to find a restaurant. Yeah. You know, everything is so expensive. Landlords are crazy. Crazy.
Well, and if
I
we
mean,
all
to buy
remember
a business, to buy a restaurant, it costs you a fortune. Yes, I have an investor. I can have $3 million if I want tomorrow or 3 years ago. But I never forget, you know, it's a business and I need to pay back my investor. And also, I was not interested at that time to do an expensive restaurant. I was just tired to work in a fancy restaurant, feeling the white jacket, the talk, and the I feel like in the straight jacket, like just cooking for myself, my ego, and food critic. I don't want to do that anymore. I say, you know what? Fuck it. I'm going to I want to do a restaurant where everybody can come to the restaurant, eat my food, and also do a restaurant for my friend and to have fun. I was burned of the critic. I was burned of the critic. I was burned of the people who's complaining about everything. No, it's guys, it's hard for a chef. You know I do mistake. I'm not perfect. I do mistake, and I still do mistake. But I just don't want this pressure anymore. You know, I want people to leave me alone. No, seriously. No, but guys, it's hard, you know, it's hard. I do mistake, I know that, you know. At Bastide, I did a lot of mistakes. I tried to do some new technique, new food, and nobody get it. Nobody get it. The LA time don't get it.
And I will say there was definitely new food
so
at Ludobites.
After,
yeah.
You know, I was looking for a restaurant, and I realized it was cost a fortune. It's very difficult. And I said to Chrissy, you know what, I need to cook until I find something. And after that, for that, we create with just a coincidence the pop-up restaurant. I started at Bread Bar doing a special event, and it was a success. And I don't know how, but it was a success.
It was a smashing
it was,
success.
Like I said all the time, it was in the F bakery. You know, it was just in the bakery. It was a big risk for me to just go cook in the bakery, you know, with no service almost, no tablecloth, I mean, all these things, just, and so try to do good food, you know. It was just...
That actually leads me to my next question for both of you, because these are unconventional spaces. In one hand, you're cooking on a truck. On the other hand, you're cooking in who knows where, honestly, not knowing what the equipment's going to be like and your staff and all of that. And I've heard stories of you moving entire kitchens around for Ludobites. So what are, you know, from a practical standpoint, with these unconventional restaurant spaces, what are some of the benefits? And then I guess what are some of the challenges that come along with working? And again, I'll start with you, Roy.
For me, everything about it was different. So I was on the streets, you know, like serving food on the street. So I guess the benefit was freedom. When we started cooking, he was running away from critics. I didn't even know about critics. You know, like, I was slinging tacos at 1 a.m., you know, in East Hollywood. So I wasn't even in that state of mind, in that place, even close to it. I was on the other side of the universe. And so it was complete freedom cooking and... for me personally, why it fit so well was because I'm a child of an immigrant family. And so being around that and growing up around that and for so many years maybe running away from that and not looking completely in the mirror at it and confronting it and trying to be as American as I could,
And your immigrant family isn't just one immigrant family, too. You have sort of...
Yeah, our whole team, we're all immigrant children. And so, like, really just looking at it and, you know, when we finally let go, somewhere in the midst of the midnight, you know, everything just took over. But so it's almost like I had never been inside a truck before, but it all came naturally because I had been inside liquor stores, I'd been inside dry cleaners, I'd been inside, you know, small little restaurants and burger stands. So it all kind of, for me, came natural. And that's it's weird because for me as a cook, I had only been around big burners and all these things. So it just felt so good. It felt like a glove.
You know? But at the end of the day, you know, it has to be. I mean, what are some of the challenges of you're in a moving vehicle and you have to cook, you know, on your feet and you only have what you have there at any time?
Yeah.
And the lines that would show up. I mean, the lines early on were legendary.
Do you have a kitchen when you start the truck to prep?
No, on the truck. Yeah. everything on the truck.
Wow. I'm sure it was something for you, huh?
Yeah, it was something. You know, we did. We broke a lot of laws.
So if you, when did you prep? I want to know what you prep.
If you ate at Kogi in 2008, 2009,
you prepped the food.
We didn't prep it like.
Well, honestly, the health department at that point didn't even really have a strategy to deal with food trucks.
No, man, we were prepping in the back of the car. You were typewriting like this. We were prepping like this. Like we were everywhere. We were on hoods. We were prepping anywhere we could find space, Chef.
We're all still alive, so I think it's okay.
But I don't know. It came as instinct. The lines, the people, everything that was happening outside the truck was feeding me inside the truck as I was feeding them outside the truck. You know, so it was just like it was this energy that we were sharing with each other, and none of us knew what was going on. And I think that was part of the joy of it and what got me through it. You know.
Yeah. Ludo, than you, obviously. I think going into a different restaurant, we all kind of saw a bit on Ludo Bites America, if any of us watched the show, some of the challenges that went along with getting into a new space every few weeks or every night or something. Talk a bit about that.
I mean, the problem for myself, it was most of the time when I take a restaurant for Ludo Bite, I'm sharing the kitchen with the existing restaurant. Most of the time I go to some restaurant, they're open for breakfast and lunch. So they're doing their operation, and I'm coming with my team around 2 o'clock, and that's a switch. So we share everything, guys. You know, we share the walking if we have a walking.
We don't have subtitles for Ludo tonight, but it's okay. He's doing
walking.
Walk in.
Walking. Walking.
We'll get it.
Walking. I mean, you know, I work in some restaurant where I was dealing with some cook, you know, from the existing restaurant. They just don't know how to clean, don't know how to be organized. So it was a nightmare for me because I'm a freak in the kitchen. No, but not the bad way, but I'm very...
No, that sounds fun, actually.
No, but very picky, you know, like, I want my finger, you know, for all organization. So it's very difficult to share a kitchen. And most of the time, I was going to the bakery or breakfast place, and I'm very limited with my menu, you know, with the execution. It's like Roy on the truck, you know. I mean, I just have 4 burners, and I need to do amazing food with that. And sometimes people don't realize that, you know, we are very limited too, I'm sure you too. You want to do some more things, but you cannot.
I had to switch my way of thinking.
Exactly. You know. And me too, same thing too. You know, before, I have a 15 cook with me at Bastide, and after I finish with 2 cook at a bread bar. You know, I need to do something about that. You know, it was less manipulation. I mean, just you need to be smart. It's good to push yourself. But it was very difficult for me, that. Nightmare.
Do you think for both of you that the limitations actually informed the food in any way? The kinds of dishes that we were seeing, you know, was... Because in other forms of art, a lot of times the restrictions actually can lead to more creativity. So I'm curious if you found that with cooking in a truck and cooking in a pop-up space.
I mean, for myself, you know, it was good for me. Actually, I like it because I really push myself and I learned a lot about me. And I learned a lot to just take 3 ingredients and do some food with that. When I was at Bastide, guys, it was just 8 things on the plate. You know, it was just more complicated, more frou-frou. So, more Frenchy, you know. And you have five cooks on one plate, you know, we're all around. When I did my first pop-up at Bread Bar, it was just 2 guys with me. So you need to be smart with that. You know,
yeah.
I mean, you too, you know, the truck.
Yeah, it's, I mean, for me, it was everything that Kogi became. Every limitation, every thing around me, every moment, every situation that we were in defined the food. So everything that came out of Kogi during that time was almost like a mural or a painting of what we were going through. And it was like a journal. So, like, that food actually reflects that moment in time in Los Angeles. And then now it's become...
When did you open the
2008. Right around this time.
Yeah, so, yeah, 2008 was a very interesting time for Los Angeles and for all America. Well, you know, I mean, we're on recession, and we're still on recession.
I said again, also not a coincidence, I think, that there was an economic downturn and crash at the same time that people looking for restaurant opportunities decided they had to do something different. You know, I think a lot of that has to do with the economy.
I mean, look, chef, we need to adapt ourselves with what's going on around us. And at that time, you know, I mean, I realized that too in the fancy restaurant, people don't want to spend any more $200 per person for go eat some food, some good food. You know, well, it was just reality.
And I think, you know, Roy, you said something interesting a second ago about it representing a moment in time in Los Angeles. And I'm interested to know, do you think the city had a role in either of your enterprises coming to be? I wonder a lot when I see, you know, the food trucks in such a car culture, the pop-up in such a sort of temporary mindset that we have of as Angelenos. Do you think these could have happened anywhere else? Or do you think the city of Los Angeles had any influence?
For me, it couldn't have happened anywhere else except Los Angeles. I mean, there was street food going on in Austin and Portland. At MIT, I think they had a lot of trucks. Chicago had their prepackaged trucks. There's street food and trucks throughout America going on. But this culture of not only before the gourmet food truck thing happened, but when we were starting to go out there, is because... I don't know, you know, in L.A., it's still kind of like the Wild West, you know, like, we can still get away with stuff. It's like, we don't have to start the top down all the time here in L.A., where I just got back from New York, you know, it's like, it would be unheard of in New York to, like, start something, you know, almost in, like, a flash mob type of way, and then just let it develop into part of your life. You have to go through so many safety gates and legislation and so many licensing rules and things, but I don't know, for me, in my experience in L.A., we almost, it's kind of like ask for forgiveness, you know, like, you know, type of thing. Like, you just do it, and we're kind of so laid back here. It's like, if it's good, it's just like, okay, sure, no problem.
Well, and I think you even more, from a culinary standpoint, and I've heard you talk about this before, the cuisines that you're, you know, this is Korean food and Mexican food, which is not only you, but also very much the city and its enclaves. And I think in that way, I wonder if it's a uniquely Los Angeles cuisine on top of everything else.
That's true. And it just kind of fit into the city. It's almost as if it was always there, you know? And that was the most amazing thing about Kogi is it wasn't there. And then when it did exist, it was almost like it was always there because it was coming from the people, the residents of the city. But being Latino, being Korean. And the reason why I think that also is a huge thing for America is because a lot of our cultures haven't had a voice in pop culture up until this point, you know, because our parents are, English is still a second language to them. So we're the first kind of generation that is really expressing ourselves. And so this is, you know, it was a big deal.
Yeah,
and it could have only happened here because of the Mexican and Korean cultures and a lot of the Asian culture. Because you go anywhere else, if you go to Miami, it's going to be Puerto Rican and Cuban and Dominican. So it's not going to be Mexican. And so that's why I think it's so distinctly L.A., you know.
Ludo, could Ludo Bites, I wonder about just the number of places that are only able to serve, you know, lunch and breakfast and don't have wine and beer licenses and how all that, if that has any role on Ludo Bites coming to be.
You ask me if I can do Ludo Bites somewhere else? Like,
well, you have, and we'll get to later, I think you will. But
ago. Yeah.
But could you think it could have started anywhere?
For sure, not in France. For sure.
would it because of the French or because of the...
Because of French, the way we live. I mean, people will... At that time, I think 5 or 6 years ago, I don't think so you can do a Ludo Bite in Paris, you know, with no tablecloth, no frou-frou, or you don't have the plate, they're not
they
matching sometimes, or you don't have the same chair or table. French people are very like this, you know, so Paris for sure not. And New York, I don't know about New York, but you know, when I see, I just came back from New York. I mean, New York changed a lot, of course, but New York is more high-end. When I go over there, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's more high-end. People dress fancy. So I think LA, you know, it was a perfect city for me to try this new pop-up, whatever, restaurant moving around. I think people in LA, they're pretty open, you know, and... You know, see what it was with Roy. I mean, open the pop-up, same time of Roy, you know. And, I didn't see myself doing a pop-up 5 years ago in the fancy city because the concept, because I cut all the costs, you know, about nice silverware, plate, or, you know, curtain or whatever, napkin or tablecloth. And LA is not fancy like this, I don't think so. LA is not fancy. LA is more casual. That's just reality. Like, say, Roy is more Wild West. Is that what you mean? Wild West.
Wild West.
You know, yeah. I think so. When I think about LA, I feel more like this. You know, I think we're more more cool.
I think so, right?
No, but you know, you see that when you go to big city like Chicago or New York is more, it's more fancy. You know, it is.
Well,
you know,
I think we're forgiving. I think we don't care as much for the trappings of a restaurant. Like you're saying, the French would never have
no
tablecloth. We wear blue jeans. Blue jeans. I sound 100. We wear we wear jeans everywhere. And in the city. And I think it says a lot. People didn't give Angelinos a lot of credit for our respect of food. They thought it was all about the scene. And I think that we've proved recently that we could care less about where we're eating. We'll eat on a curb, but we, as long as the food is interesting. So, and in that, I'm curious, since we're talking about how Angelinos feel about restaurants. You know, one of the criticisms I've heard of both pop-ups and trucks is that it hurts the conventional LA restaurant industry. You know, Angelinos kind of have a bad habit of only caring about what's new and exciting and hot, and pop-ups are great for that. We can go to a place for 2 weeks and then forget about it and try again, and trucks are a similar enterprise where it's very sort of transient. And I'm curious what, you know, we're reached a point where now there are trucks everywhere. And there's sort of a critical mass, and you've spawned a zillion pop-ups. I can't even keep up anymore. So I'm curious, how do you think this has done for the conventional restaurant industry in the city? Has it hurt it, or do you think it's going to eventually come back and bolster the industry?
You go first.
Whoever wants to reach out on that one first.
You say who's going first?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh well.
I'm the chef. He said the chief of the conventional restaurant. Okay. Actually, Ludo, I know you have. I've heard you talk about this before, just with pop-ups. So I'm curious to
what?
With pop-ups. I've heard you talk a bit about there being maybe too many.
I mean, now, you know, I mean, the pop-up thing, the pop-up scene, you know, it's a lot of pop-up everywhere. You know, everybody's in pop-up now. It is, you know. People pop up everywhere, you know.
It's true. Right now, something is popping up right now.
But look, I think it's great, you know. I think it's great. I mean, people are very creative. I mean, they want to cook. But at the end of the day, you know, a pop-up needs to be good too, you know. I mean, it's yeah. But I don't know what the definition for pop-up, because I don't consider myself like a pop-up. I'm more like a restaurateur. You know, I don't know who's called me a pop-up, but everybody.
It's true because
people don't realize, guys. But you know, when I do a pop-up, you know, I mean, I hire my staff, I pay my staff, I pay my supplier, I pay a rent to the owner of the restaurant, I have a payroll company, I have an insurance. I mean, I operate like a real restaurant. I pay my tax, everything, guys. And people don't realize that. You know, it's a business. And you have some people doing a pop-up, actually. Oh, you have this guy, this pop-up tonight over there in this restaurant.
And it's at someone's apartment.
They're just a guest chef. Yeah. They don't take any risk. And guest chef, you get paid and you don't take risk. You know, it's just... So, you know, I don't know what exactly was the definition of a pop-up, but whatever, we have a lot of pop-up. You know, like in 2 weeks, I'm going to pop up in a Roy truck.
Uh-huh. You're ready.
Yeah, why not? I mean...
When he gets on one word, it goes.
He'll say it a lot.
But guys, it's like what happened with Roy. It's like happened with a truck with Roy. Roy was really the first chef to bring back in town, you know, in Los Angeles, to bring back the craziness about food truck. It's Roy who's really bring back the truck. Help me, please.
The phenomenon.
The lifestyle of truck. You know, it's him. It's him. And after everybody copy him, everybody copy these guys. And me too, I have a truck now.
He does.
You know, but a lot of truck. A lot of truck close too, because some trucks are just bad. And I think pop-up is the same thing too. Some pop-up, they close too. They don't happen anymore, you know? And I don't think so truck or pop-up is going to affect restaurant. If you're good, you're good, you know? That's it.
What do you think about our talent? You know, we've got all these great chefs, and instead of kind of working in a kitchen and starting out and going, you know, working an apprenticeship or a sous chef.
You mean the chef who's get fired and do a pop-up after?
Yes, yeah. We won't name names, but I know who we're talking about. So there's some chefs out there, and, you know, I wonder if we're losing our, you know, these young egos see TV chefs and they say, you know, I don't need to serve the time. I just want to go and open my pop-up and get famous that way, and I don't ever have to, you know, put in the time. And I'm curious if we're losing talent that way, if you think. Through this being so popular.
Well, I had a couple kids come to me and looking for advice because they're coming out of culinary school and things like that. The main thing I asked them was, like, there's a difference between being a restaurateur and being a chef. Like, if you want to be a chef, there's no shortcut. You know, you have to learn the craft. But that doesn't mean you can't be a successful restaurateur. You could open a bun shop or, like, a roasted pork shop and, like, there could be masses out there. You could win a TV show on Food Network and do all these things and be popular. But that doesn't make you a chef. So it really comes down to the craft itself still remains and exists. But the craft of being a chef doesn't always necessarily equate into becoming successful, you know, as far as like being popular and making money. So I don't know if I'm making sense.
Yeah.
But that's a huge difference. But you can be a chef and a restaurateur, but you can't be just a restaurateur and think you're a chef.
Absolutely.
To answer your question, I don't think we're losing. There's still talented fucking people out there. Young guys, you know, pushing mise en place, you know, tight, just really aggressive, competitive, extremely, like, thorough and knowledgeable. But there are a lot of schmucks out there, too.
Yes.
Yeah.
But
I feel sometimes the definition of chef. Nobody knows what is a chef exactly. What is a chef?
The chief.
A chief. Mm-hmm. It's somebody who would manage. It's like the army. You have the colonel and you have all these guys, you know? And a chef is to teach how you cook, how to cook. And you have so many chefs, they came to see a sous chef or whatever, they came to see me. Oh, Ludo, I want to be your sous chef. Okay, fine. What's your experience? I just finished school. I mean, they have no experience, nothing, you know, they don't realize. A chef, you know, it's managing it, teaching your cook. I mean, it's you need to know a lot about food. I mean, I'm a chef. I'm always sometimes scared to have a new cook in my kitchen because I hope I'm good enough to teach him. It's a lot of pressure. And so we have some people doing a pop-up and, you know, they're not chef at all, you know. They're just line cook somewhere. I mean, I'm happy for them, good. But the end of the day, I mean...
You need training.
Training, you know, people are not patient. And
yeah, neither of you came out of nowhere. You know, like as we said, your resumes are long and exciting.
I cooked for 26 years. You know, I'm still scared to go every day in the kitchen to do mistake.
Still?
I'm still, of course.
Did you say that?
And I'm still learning my job too. I'm still learning my job.
I mean, really, what he mentioned as far as like training the next generation, that scares me every day I wake up.
Yeah.
Because what if I run out of information? they're going to look at me.
I have
like,
some guys.
It's going to be silent in the kitchen
one day.
There'll
be silence, you know? So I'm constantly pushing, trying to
lot,
make sure.
I have a lot of chefs, sous chefs work with me, you know, and I beat up them in the kitchen. I beat up them, you know. And, you know, they can be a chef now. For example, I have a sous chef work with me for like 7-8 years. Sydney, you can read the story about Sydney in my book. You know, I beat up him. You know, but now he's a chef.
What did you do to him?
I beat up. I mean, not physically, yeah. But you know, to push him, of course.
So I'm curious also, you know, both of you now, having come out of, you know, the Kogi world and Ludo Bites, both are moving or have moved toward now back into the restaurant space. You have A-Frame, you have Sunny Spot, you've got Chago. You're working on a restaurant with John and Vinny from Animal, which we can all be very excited about in the future. So I'm curious, what's driving you back to what drove you back and what's driving you back to be ready to go back into the conventional restaurant world?
For me, it's because the economy, you know, we change a little our way to do a restaurant, you know, to try to cut all our costs, mm-hmm. to make the restaurant more accessible for you guys. Because as a chef, I realize I want to cook for everybody and not just to do a menu at $200 per person. You know, I think that's the real job as a chef, to cook for everybody. Like Roy do, you have a restaurant, food truck, yeah. It's very accessible. You know, it's a good example too. I like that. But some restaurant, it's too casual, like way too casual. You go to the restaurant and the service sucks, you know, because, you know, they cut the cost or whatever. And I think we need to go back a little bit to the, not the French frou-frou, but to find a little a way to bring back a little tradition about restaurant. Yep. And not just casual and just put the food over there and people share, do whatever they want. With I like it too, it's a great concept. But for myself, I think I want to bring back a little the, not the frou-frou, but a little more, I want to create more, a little more refined, maybe a refined restaurant.
Do you miss it? Is that why?
I don't want to lose that, you know? I don't want to lose that.
Do you miss it? I mean, No,
I don't want to miss it. I still don't want to do a really fancy one. I don't miss that because, like I say, I don't want to be a cook for too much for critique and this pressure. I don't want that. I mean, we always come fast, so nothing we can do. But I want to... How do you say in English?
See if I can translate.
No, I want to do a refined restaurant where I want my cook to be dressed the same, the staff. I don't want them to have a baseball hat.
I took mine off.
I'm joking. I don't want them to have tattoo anymore.
Again.
I'm just tired of people. Break me because my tattoo, I'm tired of that. People don't know, guys, I have tattoo for 16 years, okay? So stop to say, okay? But anyway, I don't want to lose this lifestyle of eating, you know, to go to the restaurant and to have a menu with appetizer, entree, and dessert.
How you novel know, these days.
But it is.
I mean that.
You don't want to forget that. And maybe I want to come back a little to that. You know, I don't know yet. But I want to create something new again. You know, like Roy creates a truck, I create a pop-up. But as a chef, it's my job to create. Yeah. You know, I want to create a new lifestyle in restaurant for the LA people. And I don't know how I'm going to do that yet. I'm still working on that, but...
Well, and you've already done it. What drove you to, you know, you very soon after, I think, Kogi was open maybe just a couple years when you opened A-Frame. What motivated you to open a real sit-down restaurant?
Well, a lot of it happened naturally. We met one of the first people standing in line, owned a bar within the first year of Kogi, first 6 months of Kogi. And so we ended up using his bar, kitchen, and then that just naturally developed into a relationship where him and I became partners, and then we got A-Frame together. And so everything just seemed natural. I had no plan. I was never a restaurateur or had my own restaurant before that. I was just a chef, you know, and I just received a paycheck and a salary, and before that I was a cook. So it was all new to me, but it came so natural. It just, I think I didn't make any decisions or try to overthink anything. So I approached the restaurants the same way as if it was a truck or as if I was just cooking at home. And I just made them the way that I like to eat. It was a chance for me to really cook the way that I grew up, the way that my extended families eat, and just sharing food and sharing experiences. You know, so to me, there was no distinction or no discrimination. It just happened to be that they were restaurants or buildings. But I opened more trucks, too,
yeah,
along
at
with
the same
that.
Time.
So, to me, it was there was no line. It was just about cooking and continuing to evolve and get it out there. I would have cooked on airplanes, too. But I would have cooked anywhere. I was basically looking for anywhere to cook. I was on a huge wave and a huge momentum to just...
A creative momentum.
I don't, you know, if I look back now, I don't know how we did it or how I was able to train so many people to cook in so many different spots in L.A. all at the same time.
Well, and that's been your secret now, is, and I've talked to you before about having, it's the people under you that really enable you to be able to diversify and have as many operations that you do.
How many trucks do you have now, Roy?
Four trucks.
Four trucks? Then how long did it take you to open the four truck?
We had five. I had to take one off the road, not because of business, but because I couldn't get it, you know, like, I like to be at every one at least once a night. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Five was just too much, but now, with two LA trucks, one Orange County, and one catering, I'm able to see them. But they go far. It's my toughest nights are when there's one in Pomona and one in Northridge. Like, you know,
like, Do you have a helicopter? You try to be at every property and every truck every day.
I try to. Luckily, the restaurants are all on one street.
That makes it easy.
You never want to do a new truck, Roy? A new concept of truck?
I would love to.
These are the questions.
I don't know.
I would love to.
Oh, sorry, I cannot talk about that. Sorry.
Yeah, I know.
No, I get it. I think Chego, we have a rice bowl restaurant called Chego. I think that, if
that's
that
cool
was
about
turned
that. I like
into a truck.
One.
Yeah, yeah. I first met you in Venice, but second time I met you.
Yeah, I like Chego.
If that was a truck, I think it would be good. It's a rice bowl
truck.
I think it would work well.
So you're going to have some more truck guys soon.
So while we're moving on to new enterprises, I'll ask. I've heard from very disturbing rumors, Ludo, that there will be no more Ludo Bites, at least here.
Never trust rumor.
Never trust the media?
Never trust the media. I'm so pissed off these days with media, guys. You have no idea.
It's been a hard week.
That's my last thing I'm doing, guys. That's my last interview I'm doing tonight. I don't do any more interview until I open the restaurant. That's it.
I feel lucky to be here. Thank you.
I just, you know, you say something and they say something else.
But so.
I don't know if it's because of my English, but so.
But Ludo, it's true. Ludo Bites, though.
Yeah, we have Ludo Bites, yes.
Ludo Bites. So, I know you, for those who don't know, you also have a Ludo Bites truck, which I know will stay in operation with the fried chicken, which is wonderful. Mm-hmm. But then, but the Ludo Bites pop-up, as far as we know, you did 10, I think was in Hawaii, if that's right, which was the most recent one. And then I'm not sure what your future plans are at this point.
You know, Ludo Bite was a big success and something fun in my career, comedy career.
Carrier.
Yeah, I don't know. Carrier as a chef. And I thanks all people from LA because they support me and I'm successful because of them. And I thanks to all the bloggers. Still, some I don't like it. But, you know, they make Ludo Bite. Don't ask for that. You know, I still want to continue Ludo Bite. I still want to do one more Ludo Bite before I open my restaurant in collaboration with Vinny and Johnny. Just to say thanks to everybody and to do the best of Ludo Bite. You know, I really want to do that. Just to a celebration, you know, the good the end. But after that, the Ludo Bite brand, I want to take it outside Los Angeles and to different cities around America and after around the world. Like now, I'm talking maybe to go to Mexico City.
Wow.
And I would love maybe to do a Ludo Bite in San Francisco. I went over there last week and it looks like maybe I'm going to do one over there.
You always come back, though, right?
Of course. And I don't forget where I'm from. I'm from Burgundy and LA.
I like that. In that order.
Yeah. You know? I have a tattoo of Los Angeles, guys, okay? But Ludo Bite, I still want to do Ludo Bite. Of course, you know, I think it's a fun concept. And like, say, Roy, with the truck, I have a freedom. I do what I want. It's like, you know, I change location, I change the menu, I do what I want. You know, I have no rule. I love it. That's what I like. And the chef is nothing more priceless to have your freedom, guys. For us and for you too, like this, we are creative. You know, it really opens us to be like something different, I think, for myself, you know.
No,
I love it.
Yeah.
Huh? Seriously. I'm so scared to open a restaurant and to be stuck with the same concept all the time. It'd be so boring.
And I don't think you could do it.
No, I don't
know
think so, no.
You well enough to know.
That's for that, you know,
you're
since
unemployable.
I did.
in that way. Well, and
that's
and
for that the concept of the restaurant. I don't talk about that anymore. It changed already 3 times.
Yes, I know from my interview.
Yeah, you already.
Four concepts back.
Yeah, everything.
But Roy, I want to ask you too. You know, you were talking about how you've changed, and I think you definitely have. I want to ask you just to set the record straight about something you said a while back in a blog that sort of took the world by alarm. Everybody was a little worried because you said that you might be thinking about eating in a more vegetarian manner, which for the guy that, you know, has the chubby pork belly bowl and is, you know, invented Korean short rib tacos, we're wondering, well, what's the deal? So talk about that. I know you've had a bit of a, you know, the last year has been a really transitional one for you.
Yeah, that happened in April. I just had had a soul-searching moment, and by the way, the name of my company is called Meat, so that we can preface this whole
so it gets
the
a little...
whole like diatribe on that. But the thing is, like, I just reached a point where, you know, I had a nervous fucking breakdown. You know, I had a nervous breakdown. I looked at everything. I was like, what the hell am I doing? You know, I'm feeding all of these people. And then all the people that I hang out with and that I grew up around, a lot of kids that I know, are eating, like, processed meats, you know, fast food daily, you know, frozen sliders from 7-Eleven, you know, like, day in, day out. Not for a snack and not for a joke and not for fun. You know, the meat that they're getting from Food for Less and from discount bargain markets and stores, you know, hardly drinking any milk, hardly eating any vegetables. And so for me, what I figured is I've done almost everything I can to get food as far and as deep as possible, and there's still so many places to go and so many things to do. So when I thought of that, I thought maybe, you know, I got this meat shit on lock. You know, like, I can do it. I can close my eyes. I can cook whatever I want with meat. So maybe if I start eating less meat, and start really focusing my energies on vegetables. Then from there, you know, Gandhi said that, you know, if you're going to start change, you do it with yourself first. So I figured if I could change, and then, you know, maybe I'll find a new flavor.
All right. Quickly, because I want to move on to another little surprise that I have for both of you, but I just want to ask sort of quickly, where do you think this trend is going? I mean, do you think, are we done? Have we seen it? Are we ready to sort of bounce back to where you guys are both going?
Let me tell you something.
Okay. All right.
Something I agree with Roy, definitely, is I think chef now, we need to be a little more responsible about what we feed to our customer. Yes, meat is good. Fat is good. Yeah, pork belly, breast, whatever. But I think it's time for two to stop a little that, and I agree with Roy, to maybe a little more vegetable and a little bit more responsible about what we do. You know, it's. I mean, I'm a little overwhelmed sometimes in to see all the menus sometimes the same in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. It looks like, you know, food is a trend, definitely, don't get me wrong. So I really respect Roy, you know, to try
belly,
to eat,
lamb,
yeah, exactly,
beef,
whatever, you know. It's easy to cook that. I mean, I don't say easy, chef. Yeah. I'm sorry. But
no, but like you said about...
You take the pork belly, you cook it for 12 hours. Wow, it's good.
Yeah.
But take a carrot. Make something beautiful. Chef, carrot.
Yeah, try to make a meat carrot.
No, exactly. You know, I mean, cook the carrot maybe like a meat, you know, like a steak. I don't know. But I really understand what Roy is saying, you know, and the trend, I think, for me, the way I see the food, it's more healthy. Healthy. It was going to be very difficult for me as a French chef, cream butter.
Yeah, I know.
So I'm going to do like you now. Yeah. No more butter the morning, no more cream. I'm going to set that now at the house. Okay, Chrissy? No more butter the morning. I'm saying, well, no, but I
That's
think,
miserable.
You know, I think it's you know, I mean, I think we need to be responsible too, you know, chef, and try to teach people maybe, you know, to... give them some more excitement with different things. And like say, Roy, you know, try to... I'm not going to be a vegetarian for sure, but... but you know what? But you know what? But I realize when I cut to eat meat, you know, for like 4 or 5 days, I try to do that sometimes, I feel much better. Yeah. It's like when I don't drink alcohol, same thing too.
Let's not go that far.
What was your question?
The question was just, where do you think the trend is going? You know, he was speaking
healthy.
Very ingredient based, but you know, are we ready? Where are food trucks going? Do you think it's going to be another evolution? Is there a next step, or do we think we're kind of where we are, and there's going to be a? Is there a next thing that's going to be?
He told you like 10 minutes ago. Airplane. Airplane.
Yeah, private jet.
They want to do the airplane.
Very few of us are going to get to sample that.
He's going to do an airplane somewhere in the airport this
submarine.
One.
I said SpaceX earlier.
Yeah, that's something new. Trust me, the shuttle is come back for something.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, this guy is he's smart, this one. Trust me, he's smart.
I think I was thinking about that. I had no idea what you were going to ask, but I figured something would be, how do you feel about the current state of, you know, food and street food and trucks and stuff. And I just finished his book, and I was thinking about, like, what he did and I did.
Do you understand?
With my team. Yeah, I understood. what we did concurrently in 2007, 2008 together, and how radical that was. And then thinking about where it's at now, what I'm afraid of is that it becomes like Banana Republic, you know, like where these ideas and these thoughts and this energy ends up being copied and pacified and then turned into something that no longer has kind of
soul.
A connection or a soul back to where it was. But on the other side, I think we have to go through that. The thing about street food is that I don't know if we can put, you know, like a death ticket on it, because there's a lot of mediocre stuff out there, but we have to go through that because we're so, so early in the evolution of it. You know, it existed within every immigrant community that came to America through Ellis Island and also through San Pedro, you know, and it came all the way through. But the thing is, in this new movement now, we're too young into it to give up on it. And so I hope it evolves. I hope that we can narrow it down to where it can be passed on. There'll be more chefs involved. We can stop going for the gimmick and the bells and whistles and start really focusing. I don't know if any of you have been out to Southeast Asia, to Vietnam or Thailand, or, you know, like to just really focus on food where you can really have just one thing and have that one thing delicious.
Be done well.
And be done well and passed on. So,
well, talking...
I'm doing a crepe restaurant.
A crepe restaurant.
Just crepe.
I'd go.
Thing.
That would be awesome.
So we're talking about the future, but I want to take a minute and go back to the past a little bit. We are all here at the LA Public Library, which I don't know if many of you know, has one of the best menu collections archives in the country. They have hundreds and hundreds of menus that date back over a century that we have access to. So I went through before the panel and picked out a few menus from Los Angeles' past that I thought you guys might have some thoughts on, because some of them are particularly directed toward you. So I want to just take a look. We've got some slides up here. This one in particular is for Ludo.
Oh, man.
This is a menu from L'Orangerie that I found that is actually from right around the end of your term. I think it was like 2002, 2003 that this menu was from. I want you to go ahead and look. You'll see the
guys,
first menu
on there.
Guys,
can I see something, guys? Can I see something? Stop the menu. Stop the menu.
Okay.
Stop. This is not mine.
Yeah, it's 2004.
This is not mine. This is from another chef.
I thought perhaps you might remember a few of these. I thought perhaps
you might remember. But guys, that's exactly what I say. The journalists, they just do mistakes.
We get our facts wrong.
That's not my menu, guys.
I'm not saying this is what you cooked, but I'm wondering, the foie gras... I was looking at the first item, though, which I was wondering if perhaps your person after you took from you, which is, by the way, a creme brulee of foie gras with popcorn, which sounded very Ludo-esque to me. So I was curious about that dish, if you remember inspiring that in any way.
The what, foie gras?
No, yeah. No, the foie gras with popcorn.
That's not
I menu. Know it's not your menu. I'm asking you. Okay.
So he's about to say.
Well, you asked me how I find the inspiration?
Yeah, no, I'm asking if you remember if whoever did cook this menu the year after you.
Yeah, it was Christophe Belanca.
Did he take any cues from you with a foie gras and popcorn? I just said that sounds like a very Ludo Bites dish.
No, because he did that before me, so I guess it's me.
I guess it is. Well, either way, it's 140 per person, so I don't know if that would fly today at L'Orangerie. But there was foie gras on there, which
yeah,
I know.
Yeah, foie gras, and crème brûlée, ravioli is very French.
You miss.
It's very Frenchy. You
okay. Know? We don't.
You don't see any Asian thing on the menu. It's very French, but...
It is very French.
That's why it's not my style.
Okay. We'll move beyond L'Orangerie.
Yeah.
Okay.
I hope it's you.
This I just found really funny. So this is a place that was from about 1984. This is a Korean restaurant in Los Angeles that was on Hillhurst. And I just really liked the cuisine type, by the way, which we can just read aloud, which is Korean barbecue Japanese food sushi bar, which is definitely, talk about fusion.
That was pre-fusion.
Yeah, this is pre-fusion. And I'm curious, I mean, where was Korean food in the 80s,
It was
Roy?
In a good place. Well, in a really good place. It's just not many of y'all were eating it.
I know. They didn't have an English menu.
But
if you can look, there's a whole menu of Japanese, which I found interesting. And then there's a whole menu that gets into bulgogi, which is with a K that I hadn't seen before, I noticed on there. And then there's a whole menu of Korean food. And I was curious for us, the non-Korean population, if you kind of had to pair it with sushi for us to really understand what Asian food was at that point.
They still do that, but the great, great thing is Korean food hasn't gone up that much in
price.
You
see that?
I know.
That's crazy.
It's still about the same.
You see this one, chef? Fish bouillabaisse.
Oh, yes. Sangsang-gul.
I guess it's Korean style, fish bouillabaisse.
Yeah.
So this was the Korean one. It reminded me of Guy Fieri's restaurants, which is Tex Wasabi's Sushi Barbecue that he has as his collection of restaurants. So it seems like a very similar fusion. But
it was very cheap, guys, huh?
It is.
It was not expensive.
Yeah, well, you want to see cheap, wait till we get to the future. So here we have La Fonda, which was in Glendale, which has a questionably appropriate stereotypical image on the front. But it's a really cool menu, and I wanted to talk about prices. You can look here. The chili relleno for 30 cents. I thought, Roy, there's a barbecue taco up there that I think might predate yours by a little while. That's 10 cents each. This was 1950s was all they said. They didn't have a specific year.
1950?
So this is 1950s. They get into, on the next page when it explains, I like how specific they got with ingredients.
How
it just says
they,
barbecue
how do
meat.
Money, chef?
Yeah, I know.
I mean, they have a free rent or?
It wasn't Glendale.
50 cents.
It says barbecue meat and sauce, which nowadays you have to not only name the farmer and where it was from and what day it was killed. We were satisfied in the 50s with just meat and sauce. We didn't ask any more questions than that.
But why not? You know what? If it's good, it's good. Meat and sauce.
It was. La Fonda was. You still have it. Okay, let's move on. So this one I thought was really interesting. This is the Southern Pacific train. This is 1959. And I don't know if you noticed the special guest that they had on the train at this date. This was Nikita Khrushchev in 59, who was invited on the train. And I learned before this, not invited to Disneyland while he was here. He could not go to Disneyland. But he was here. Now, talk about mobile cuisine. This is what I wanted you guys to see about. So you guys do these on trucks. This is a train car. I'm curious... A caviar frappe and an omelet with walnut jelly, if you think these could be.
Well, caviar frappe sounds very like modern.
Doesn't
you know,
it?
Seriously.
It's interesting.
What year was this menu?
This was
1959.
1959? That we had Khrushchev on there.
Wow, omelet with walnut jelly.
There's fried chicken. Which
and stripped bacon. Walnut jelly. Wow.
I know, which I'm not sure about that one, actually.
Huh?
I'm not sure about the walnut jelly.
You see, but it's funny because you see crepe with potato are still using this term on the menu too.
Whipped potatoes?
Yeah, cream with, yeah.
Which is back, actually, I think.
Yeah, it's
hot
back.
Hot rolls.
I think we're going back more and more to the tradition. You never forgot about tradition.
Well, and especially, this is the cocktail menu. This could be on any
look now with cocktail,
bar.
Cocktail, yeah.
If you look, there's a bourbon on rye, there's Manhattan. I'm surprised there isn't more vodka, considering Khrushchev was on the train. But we have an old fashioned and a Manhattan, so it seemed very oddly au courant at the moment. You do a lot of cocktail programs, Roy.
Yes, we have a wonderful guy named Brian Butler, who he approaches drinks first through the food angle. You know, he comes in and raids the kitchen and really looks at it through a food lens, and then tries to match the drinks with the food. But we have a wonderful program at both A-Frame and Sunny Spot.
Yeah. You know? No cocktails? For me?
No. I love cocktail. I love cocktail before dinner, but
not with food.
I'm still have a little hard time to eat food with cocktail. Me. But now the good thing, you have some guys who are doing cocktail, they put the chicken in the cocktail too.
Bacon, at least. I've seen that one. Yeah, no, the last time I was in Paris, you could not get a martini. If you asked for a martini, they'd give you a martini and Rossi.
Just the way that's just the way I grew up. So, you know, nothing wrong with that, to drink with, to eat with cocktail, you know. I mean, I just grew up like...
With Burgundy. Why not drink the wine?
No, but with wine, you know, but, you know, it's just the way I am, you know, just...
You don't have to like cocktails. It's... Before, so this one is very old. This is 106 years old, this menu. This is from 1906.
That's the chef?
This is not the chef. That is...
I want a chef jacket. I want a chef jacket like this.
I can see you with the epaulettes. I think it would look very good. The beard's coming in. This was from the Fremont Hotel, which was... I have the address here. Wow. It was on Olive Street on Bunker Hill, which is no longer there. It was 401 South Olive.
What year? 1846?
1906. This is a special menu that was commemorating the birthday of General F.C. Fremont, who, as you can see here, the Cahuenga Pass, he did a lot, you know, in early California history mapping during the gold rush.
So they did a menu for...
did a menu for him. That is Cahuenga Pass. I don't know if you can see, but that is... So my next food bite,
I'm going to do a menu for Chef Roy.
That's sweet.
The picture. I will put a picture. Oh yeah, I will. Yeah. I promise you.
Okay.
One night.
This one just had some interesting California ingredients. You've got ripe Mission olives that I saw at the bottom, which I thought was, I think there's a close-up of that one, which is a very California. New cucumbers, which I wasn't sure what that meant.
Okay, let me ask you something.
Yes.
Because all these things over there, it's they're talking about the ingredients they use or the old dishes?
Because
you see, they put shrimp bass, anchovy sauce. It looks like they're talking more about ingredients almost too. Mexican bell pepper. I mean, all these things.
These are the dishes. I cream of oyster soup, I have a feeling. Consommé.
Because now the chefs, the way they do menu now, and it's very interesting to see that for me, because the chef now, they just list the ingredients they use on the menu, and that's it. They don't tell you how the dish is like this, but they just put you, okay, you have asparagus, you have a chicken, you have parmesan, you have sorrel, you have rosemary, and you don't know exactly. So you make me think about that. It's funny.
No, they don't. They don't give you a description. I think Test Kitchen is like that, the one in...
Oh, yeah? It's interesting to see that like this.
They do a lot of those. The chocolate cake. Let's see. There's the other page. Virginia ham with Brussels sprouts. Brussels sprouts are back, as we all know. We've seen them everywhere.
So orange. So you have one
orange. Bisque ice cream. This sounds like a weird ice cream that would be on a Ludo menu. Not a lot of Korean food on this one, Roy, I'm sorry to say, in 1906. But this was actually just up the street. This was a menu that you would be eating in 1906. It was January 21st, so it was a very interesting time in food, and I think you can see a lot of parallels were coming back. Oranges, walnuts. That's it? Okay, well, those are the old menus.
Our Eastern cheese, yeah.
And then there's a beautiful poem from F.C. Fremont that's over there, and then a picture of the Fremont Hotel that, again, was right around the corner, which was really pretty. And there was... You can get lost in this menu archive for hours if you just search in through cuisine. There's fabulous menus.
So we can go any day downstairs.
You can go online
second
from home.
Floor, right?
Yeah, well, you can do it here, but it's actually all online digital. So you can go online and find all of these menus scanned that you can look through. So it's really, really fun. Food history buffs like myself get very nerdy about that kind of thing. I lost a couple hours doing that. I think at this point we should open it up to, I think, a few minutes of Q&A. We're going to do some questions from the audience for both Ludo. Don't ask him about l'orangerie or cocktails, though, because he gets a little cranky when that happens. Sure, yes.
Two questions for both of you. Can you recommend a restaurant where you like to eat now in L.A.? And where would you go? Not what would you have, but what restaurant would you go to for your last meal?
So, I mean, for me, I would go to Chego for my fun.
We're seeing a love affair right here.
And that's me, Ephraim.
Smart. You know what you have to say? You have to say no.
I don't know. That's a kind of a complicated question for me. I can't speak for all of you, because to me, restaurants mean different things. They don't necessarily mean a chef-driven restaurant. So, it would be a Korean restaurant called Olympic Jeongukjang.
You know, that's
restaurant I would go to for maybe like a last meal.
What would we order there?
But I, we would order a stinky, like, fermented soybean stew with tofu. And But I think in L.A., Animal, the guys, John and Vinny, are killing it. You know, like, that's a restaurant that they continue to evolve and push themselves. And in the 4 years that I've been eating there, they've gotten better every time.
That's Animal and Son of a Gun, for those who haven't been. They have both those restaurants. Okay.
His is Chego and A-Frame.
I mean, for my last meal, definitely I would love to have chicken and potato. Roasted chicken and potato. So do you know... Huh? No, it's too French. I went over there with my wife. I have a very, very bad experience. Like, first of all, it's way over so pricey. And the attitude of the French service, enough. Oh, yeah, so...
But it's the best chicken and potatoes I've ever had.
Really? Yeah.
He does not believe you.
No, I mean, I agree with you, man. I mean, it's good, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Sure.
I was wondering what rules you broke in 2008 and 2009.
Rules or laws, again? Let's
make
sure...
Well, I'm willing to have you answer what laws, but I didn't want to incriminate you. Yourself.
There's
so
a statute
rules?
Of limitations, I think that's right. But for me, the rules were serving food that was usually marked up 3 times. That's marked up only very, very, very little. So food that where the food cost was almost as high as the cost of the item itself. So we were making no profit off anything we were selling. And so that's a huge rule breaker, because the restaurant business, you're supposed to have a 28 to 32% food costs. And then even with that, they're not trying to stifle you, know, like get you, but there's labor, there's X factors, all these X costs, there's all these things in there. Whereas most restaurants only make about 15% profit anyway. So there's really not that much fat.
Yeah, not making money is probably breaking the first rule of the restaurant business.
That was a big thing. Serving the food, really serving the food on street corners where we had no licenses, you know. And going to cities and parking in parking lots, and going in cities where we would just populate the parking lot. Probably, it was probably a fire hazard.
Do you fight with people sometimes?
No, with
the officials.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you know, just.
But we were very, we had our head down, and we were extremely focused in what we were doing. And so I think, even though we were breaking rules, the food just took over. You know, it made everyone forget for a minute. You know, so, but mainly it's the breaking the structure of the restaurant was the biggest rule, I think, that happened was not having a host, not having a place to call. You know, even on our website, you know, we didn't have a phone number to call to. You had to find us. We didn't have a, we didn't cater to your desires. We just gave you what we had. And so there was a lot of that.
Was that the same for you, Ludo, similar rules that you broke, sort of in that way? I'd say the fact that you were not even in a conventional restaurant.
No, I'm an honest guy. I'm very honest. I don't break any rule.
You look in those eyes, you almost believe him.
No, but I don't think so, no. I don't break any rule.
He's looking at his wife. By the way, Chrissy Lefebvre is here in the front row. We should all say hi. She's the other half of Ludo.
I break rules. No, at least I was still in the restaurant. I mean, it was more difficult for Roy. You know, I know how it's difficult to manage a truck too.
Yeah.
I have a truck too, because him.
He did it. He broke all the rules for you. Sure. Let's go over here.
Was there an effect of the social media on the trucks and on the pop-ups?
Yes. Now Twitter and Facebook and Pinterest and Tumblr, all those things, and just even plain old-fashioned texting. I mean, it's a huge, huge impact on the restaurant business right now.
I think it couldn't have been done without Twitter.
Twitter, yeah. And I mean, it's because it's part of now the culture, you know.
I think for myself, I think Ludo Bald will not be successful or exist with not Twitter or all the media.
And the bloggers especially.
And the blogger, definitely for us, for Ludobyte. I would say the blogger made Ludobyte. You know, because when we open Ludobyte, we don't have any public relation. We just opened like this the last minute, so we don't have time to do any marketing. So many times I try to get an article from the Los Angeles magazine. I call Leslie. She always said no.
I will tell you, this was the hardest part
all
of
the
my
time,
job.
Guys. All the time, guys.
As a monthly, you just couldn't cover it. It was so difficult for me because so, you know, by the time we knew about it, it was gone.
So, you know, so, sir, just for you know, yes.
That's why.
That's great. Because the magazine, they don't follow us.
The ground game is too fast for a monthly.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
With Twitter and...
As I said, it made my job difficult. That was what I said in the intro. Yeah. Yes. Okay, great. Yes.
About the Los Angeles market, do you feel that there are any cultural cuisines that are missing here? Is there a space
that
can, what in particular?
French. I mean, where's the French, guys? I mean, yeah, we have some great chefs, like Walter is going to open a... is not French, but he's doing a good, amazing French cuisine. And one, two is Tony Esno, who's one from Patina, was a great chef too. But it's true, we don't have too many good French restaurants. I don't know why. You know why?
We did, but yeah, not a lot right now. We used to, but
French, I don't know what's wrong with us. We just don't make it.
I don't know. Ever since you left L'Orangerie, we didn't know what to do with ourselves. Oh, we're waiting for you to come.
But it's true. I mean, French people, I mean, definitely. What do you think, chef?
I try to introduce, and I'm continuing to, Caribbean French food
Brittany?
Into the city because we have to look at the makeup of the city, and sometimes the makeup, the body rhythm, and just by not having the population out here, it's hard to really infiltrate Jamaican, Haitian, food from Trinidad, Tobago, Cuban, Puerto Rican, Dominican, and we're trying that with one of my places. Another one is South American. I don't know if like South American food is. I know we have Peruvian coming through right now, but like. You know, like really, really great Argentinian, you know, gaucho barbecues and, you know, so I don't know. I mean, I don't see many like Ecuadorian and restaurants from like Paraguay, you know, or Uruguay or anything like that. So some parts of South America and the Caribbean and the West Indies, definitely.
One last question over here.
Hi, I was actually going to add to that and say, do you think that you answered that earlier when you said that it may be going healthier in your own personal interests, and actually Ludi, you said that as well, that maybe that might be that next movement that we all feel that maybe neighborhoods are missing in a fast food kind of way, but by missing health.
So you asked me
if maybe produce. That movement
that
we were asking about might go back to that question.
Yeah.
Are we moving away from meat? Are we moving toward more, you know, produce-driven and food equality?
Uh-huh. So...
So do you think that healthier food, cooking healthier could be part of the next wave of food?
Oh, definitely. I mean, for myself, yes. I think that's the next thing. Cooking healthy. Yeah. Make the food more light, still interesting, but like I say, you know, how to do, I don't know, a bœuf bourguignon, but more lighter. You know, I mean, no, it's true, but, you know, it's that. I think, I mean, that's the way I see it. That's the way I want to do. It's to revisitate a lot a classic French, but to around the world, but especially French, because we are known for cream and butter. So I really want to make the French food more lighter. You don't know how I'm so... Sometimes tired of people say, oh, you're French. Yeah, I'm French. So you're cooking very heavy. Huh? I say, it's true, French food in the past was very heavy, but I want to revisit a lot of classics from my country, but make them more...
Los Angeles.
Los Angeles, exactly. Mm. You know, like this morning, I was very surprised. I went to breakfast to a restaurant called... Sigamore, and
so
breakfast fest, yeah. And I went over there. I see a croque madame on the menu. Yeah, I love croque madame. And so sandwich came. Where's the bechamel sauce, you know? But they have this white sauce. It was liquid and very light. I don't know how they did that.
It's delicious.
It was delicious. But I think that's exactly that, you know? I think for me it's to revisit a lot of classic and make them a little more playful, fun, and healthy, you know? I'll never forget about a French chef. I know, sorry, I speak French, fat French people, but Michel Gérard, La Cuisine Minceur, he did that in the 70s. It was an amazing concept. And I think we need to go back to that a little bit. Voilà, madame.
Hope, what do you think, Roy? Do you think, I know you personally have been working a lot toward food equality movements, mm-hmm. And making sure that people, like you said, know about produce. Do you think that'll move to becoming an actual trendy food way?
Yeah, I think we as generations have to just like take a step back and, you know, like I'll bring up Asian culture. We don't have many problems with obesity and unhealthy eating because we don't eat massive amounts of unproportioned, you know, meats and or vegetables. We don't overdose on things. Everything is, you know, in a dish, you're only getting maybe 3 ounces of meat and then a lot of different vegetables and sauces. And so just eating more variety and not looking at things as healthy. I think that's the biggest mistake we're having. We're almost trying to fix things with like liquid paper, you know, like just instead of looking at it as healthy, just look at it as delicious and then just cook food and have more variety, you know, in it.
So. Absolutely.
No, I think, no. Yeah. And I think to the chef, you know, what we need to do, guys, it's to, madam, it's the food is to do teaching the kid how to cook and how to eat. I think we're all responsible here to just teach them how to respect the planet and eat the planet.
Yeah.
but it's true. But if we don't respect the planet, what are we going to eat in 50 years? No, but it's true.
It's true. Probably yeah, it's a true. Lot of...
And I think the next thing I want to do, guys, it's my new concept. No, just for... I'm going to open a kid restaurant.
What?
A kid.
I don't know if I can believe him anymore when he says these concepts.
But why not? But you know what? Since I have twins, I enjoy to cook for kids. And as a chef, I realized, like I say, it's to cook for everybody. But all my life, I just cook for adult people. So why not to open a kid restaurant? Well, it will be the mess in the restaurant, trust me. But
yeah, I know. That'll be messy.
But why not? But look, we take our kid to the restaurant, we eat what we eat. So why not us to take our kid to a kid restaurant and we eat like them too.
You already make chicken nuggets, so we're perfect with that. You're already fine.
But I think, you know...
I think
you should talk about that in your magazine.
Okay. That'll be it. You can be the exclusive. We'll be fine. It'll
thank
be
you
whole,
so much.
The kids' food issue with Ludo
maybe
Lefebvre.
One day you can talk.
I want to thank... I think that's we're out of time. I want to thank Ludo and Roy. Thank you guys so much. The Library
thank
Foundation.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks all of you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.